Trump.
Wilbur mentioned a couple of words, reciprocal trade.
One thing that separates Wilbur Ross from the other billionaires at Donald Trump's cabinet table is how far back in the president's history he goes and how important he was to making Trump what he is today.
If it hadn't been for Wilbur Ross, Donald Trump would not be in the White House.
David K. Johnson has chronicled the ups and downs of Trump's business career for three decades, including his failure in Atlantic City, New Jersey, with the money-losing Taj Mahal Casino that almost sank Trump. Ross, trained as a bankruptcy advisor, engineered a deal for Trump that kept him afloat in part by establishing that the Trump name had its own value as a brand.
Wilbur Ross was a key negotiator in Donald Trump not having to go through bankruptcy and not being swept into the dustbin of history.
I, Wilbur Lewis Ross.
This year, Ross became the United States Secretary of Commerce. He divested most of his business assets, but kept a stake in a shipping company called Navigator, where he was once chairman.
And work on a documentary about the Panama Papers.
Sure. For me, it was a story that was very unique in a number of areas. It was the largest coordinated act of journalism in history. It was really the first major 21st century scandal that was unveiled through a global network. Meaning, as you talked about yourself, Amelia, the extremely sophisticated networks that were created for the journalists to speak to each other over the internet. It was an internet-based crime. A lot of the networks, to Rita's point, it might have been hubbed in Panama, but it was a global network that was using the internet to create essentially a massive systemic act of fraud and financial inequity on an enormous scale, trillions and trillions and trillions, almost an entire shadow economy. So for me, as a filmmaker, I knew that the revelations themselves, when they were revealed in April of that year of 2016, that was just the beginning of the story. It wasn't the end of anything. It was, you know, all of these journalists, including all three of you, had spent the previous year under enormous stress, having to work in complete secrecy, which is incredibly difficult. It's really hard to use encryption technology, even now, much less 5 years ago. It's very hard for anyone to keep secrets. You're talking about hundreds and hundreds of people keeping very dangerous secrets for a year. And
when you train to be a wealth manager, you get a series of textbooks that are produced in order not only to teach you the techniques of hiding money offshore, but also to sort of indoctrinate you into an ideology that enables you to live with yourself. I spoke to 65 wealth managers around the world in 18 countries. I would say of those people, maybe one quarter at most were ethically troubled by their work. It was a good way to make a living, but they were bothered by it fundamentally. They knew it was wrong, they knew it was unfair, and that it was making the world a worse place. But another 25% were absolutely committed to this ideology, in which not only libertarian anarchism is the word of the day, but when they speak of taxes, it is only in terms that, say, Ayn Rand would approve. Literally the books that you get from the official professional society for wealth management speaks of tax as confiscatory. They speak of the state as illegitimate, especially if it does any sort of redistribution from the rich to the poor. Here's an excerpt from the wealth management training manual. Onerously high, some may say unethical tax demands to finance generous government spending clearly act as a chill upon the entrepreneur as a creator of wealth. Whereas, on the other hand, the poor may be caught in the poverty trap and rely on state welfare handouts rather than engage in productive work. In other words, tax is a moral hazard. Rich people shouldn't pay them because then poor people won't learn to bootstrap themselves up and become self-sufficient. The training manuals produced by the professional society, that is sort of the official body of wealth management, are full of such statements. I read them just aghast. I couldn't believe what I was seeing and that they meant it seriously. Then I went out in the field and interviewed people, and yep, they sure do and believe it seriously. That's what you're up against. To give you a sense of what else they're doing, this is a gentleman from my home country. He's a fraudster. His name is Kevin Trudeau. He's written a series of books, all purporting to enlighten the masses on things that rich people know that are being carefully hidden from the rest of the world. Essentially, he makes his living on junk conspiracy theories. He was convicted in U.S. federal court of fraud and fined $37.5 million. That was 10 years ago, and the U.S. government has collected zero, nothing. How is this possible? Kevin Trudeau has a very good wealth manager who preemptively put his assets in a Cook Islands Trust, that little place in the South Pacific I mentioned to you. No Cook Islands Trust has ever been breached. It's like a fireproof box for assets. So a government like the U.S., which can basically execute people by drone from, you know, thousands of feet in the air, can't collect on a debt owed to them by this little flim-flam man. I find that astonishing, but that is the power of wealth managers in this world. This is a little note that was passed by a wealth manager in the Netherlands to Mossack Fonseca. It concerns a divorce case. This gentleman, the client, knows he's getting divorced, and he wants to make sure that he leaves his ex with nothing, or as close to nothing as possible, which of course is in contravention of most European laws. My point in putting this up is to say that the same people who are responsible for what economist Gabriel Zucman estimates to be 200 billion US annually in lost tax revenue to world governments, just based on individual tax avoidance, not corporate tax avoidance, those same people are hard at work 24/7 helping their clients avoid all kinds of laws that you make, including laws about families. The wealthy people of the world, with the help of their wealth managers, basically thumb their noses at the law, period. What to do about this? Part of my reason for being here is to sort of tell you as much as I can about who your opponent is.
One of Navigator's biggest customers is Russia's largest gas and petrochemical company, Sibor. Among Sibor's owners are Kirill Shimalov, President Vladimir Putin's son-in-law, and Gennady Timchenko, an oligarch who has direct links to Putin and who's been under sanction by the U.S. government. As Commerce Secretary, Ross has influence over trade and sanctions that could affect Sibor's owners.
If I were in the business of consulting, which I am not, I would advise any client who came to me to stay well away from Sibor or anybody else who has been sanctioned.
Daniel Fried was coordinator for sanctions policy during the Obama administration.
If you know anything about the Russians, it's that under the current system, it's easy to get dirty. Don't go there, man. Don't go there.
Ross's stake in the Navigator Shipping Company is opaque. It can be traced through different companies, some of which are in the Cayman Islands, which require a little disclosure of corporate ownership. Often companies are registered there to avoid taxes. During his confirmation hearing in the Senate, Ross faced no questions about Navigator or its links to Russia and Vladimir Putin. He was asked many questions about his former role as vice president of the Bank of Cyprus, long known as the Bank of Russian Oligarchs.
And it was very popular for Australians because before we had a regime which taxed people on their foreign income if earned through a foreign entity. So if I put a foreign company in Samoa and that foreign company earned income outside Samoa, it wasn't taxed in Samoa and it wasn't taxed in Australia. Hence the benefit of having a tax haven in the middle.
For those who consider these sorts of arrangements, they're not clever or sexy or harmless. I think the victims when people don't pay taxes is everyday Australians, the millions of taxpayers who do the right thing, who declare their income, pay their employees, and have fair competition against other business.
The leaked documents show Asia City kept a confidential list of its highest risk clients, known as PEPs.
So a PEP is an acronym for politically exposed persons. And it's referring to people who hold senior government positions. They may be politicians, they may be heads of state-owned enterprises, or heads of government departments. And they may be foreign or domestic. The reason they are singled out and considered high risk is because people who are in those positions have in the past availed themselves of the opportunity to commit corruption offences.
Documents reveal hundreds of millions of dollars of Asia City's clients' money has been ploughed into the booming Sydney property market. Two luxury apartments in this city tower were purchased by a Sri Lankan, Thirukumar Nadesan, whose wife is a member of the country's ruling Rajapaksa family. He's currently facing corruption allegations. The ownership of the apartments was hidden using a shell company registered in Samoa and managed by Asia City.
Australia is seen as an easy place to park your money if you're a criminal, if you're corrupt, if you want to launder money. More Australians out there, more battlers who are trying to buy their first home are going to be competing in an increasingly unaffordable market against potential billionaires or tycoons in foreign countries, some of them involved in corruption.
In another secretive offshore setup managed by Asia City, a Singaporean company called Bright Ruby Resources spent nearly $300 million on two office towers in Sydney's CBD and bought Sydney's iconic Hilton Hotel in 2015 for $442 million. Documents in the leak reveal the six layers of companies and trusts between Bright Ruby and its ultimate owner, Chinese steel billionaire Du Shuanghua, one of Asia City's highest risk clients.
He really became quite famous in 2008 when he became the second richest man in China according to the Hurun list, which is kind of similar to our AFR rich list. In fact, there was a bit of a story about, you know, he fought off to become the richest man in China. He actually, I think, persuaded the editor to change that, because in China it's always not a great idea to become the richest billionaire, because a lot of things tend to happen to them after they top the rich list.
Controversy has dogged Du Shuanghua since he admitted to a close court in China in 2010 that he'd bribed a Rio Tinto executive millions of dollars.
He admitted to paying one of a Rio Tinto employee about $9 million in US dollars as a bribe to secure some iron ore.
Were you surprised when he admitted to paying bribes but then wasn't prosecuted?
You know why? I think you can almost see this.
Fabrication in the Panama Papers, there was virtually nothing in Delaware. Companies there, in part because Mossack Fonseca did not operate as a registered agent there. They operated in Nevada and in Wyoming to a small extent. And we can go into great conversation later on that, because both of those states feature into the ongoing debate. They certainly were interested in Delaware's business.
There's a race to the bottom among American jurisdictions who offer incorporation services, unfortunately.
And we'll come back to that on the question of beneficial ownership, but let's turn to Brian a little bit. And in your mind, over the last year, what stands out is what has or hasn't happened, positive or otherwise?
Sure, and let me say thank you, Kevin, and thank you, Aaron, and Brookings for having me here today. And Aaron, I'll say as a native Virginian, I share your suspicion of bordering states as well. So just to add that. But so maybe to expand that question a little bit, because I think it's a question of what's happened in the last year, but also understanding the framework that already exists in the United States and has existed.
German, we're in the company of Pascal Saint-Amans. He's the director of the OECD Center for Tax Policy and Administration. Serge Michel of the French newspaper Le Monde, which helped.
But in Panama any longer, they will move elsewhere. But it doesn't mean that we can't do anything. And a few things have been done. and much more needs to happen now. The proposal for a transparency register has been on the table for quite a while. It's actually quite simple to put it into place, and it's really the first step to crack down on shell companies. So far, we have the UK, which has committed to put it into place. As I said, we're waiting for France, now Germany. I think it shows that this is possible, and obviously it needs to be the first step, because then it needs to go international. So it needs to be an issue at the G20, at the OECD, and so on.
Stefan set up in the name of his butler, all right, allegedly, because that's still being discussed in the courts. Whose job is it to say, no, this actually belongs to Jean-Marie Le Pen?
The public registry people will not be in a position to deny that this guy is the beneficial owner. It has to be, the information has to be checked by the private sector. But the private sector has to be under somewhat of a transparency that we haven't seen precisely on this occasion, where in Panama, you know, the confidentiality surrounding law firms was far too high. And we've got to, you know, I'm a private lawyer, we've got to clean up our garden as well as lawyers here.
Pascal Saint-Amand, what's your religion when it comes to a transparency register?
Oh, no religion, just pragmatism. What is at stake is making sure that we know, we being the law enforcement agencies, the financial prosecutors, the taxman, the anti-money laundering authorities, that they can have access to the information of who is the beneficial owner, who's the warm body behind a corporate, a company, or a trust, or a foundation, or an Anstalt, or whatever legal vehicle. That's the question. And you're right to say that the answer belongs to the lawyer who establishes this. Now, a public registry, public or not public, by the way, can be a progress. However, there is no magic solution. If it's not provided with the right information, it will provide to the public wrong pieces of information that financial institutions, which will have to enforce automatic exchange of information, will use. They will say, well, we checked the public register, we did our job. So we need to make all the players responsible, accountable for what they do. And this is a frontier. That's why all the ideas are welcome. And the public register is one of the ideas. But we need to put the pressure on the private agent. But before that, or at the same time, we need to tell the governments to change the laws, to oblige the private players to keep the information available to the law enforcement entities, and possibly to put this information on a registry.
That doesn't look right. And it partly doesn't look right because most people cannot do the same thing. And so even if what the Blairs did was perfectly legal, perfectly legitimate in the business world, it feels instinctively really unfair because they got access to an advantage, a potential advantage, that the rest of us don't have.
Cherie Blair told the BBC they didn't request to structure the transaction this way, that after purchase they had bought the property under UK tax and regulatory rules. The spokesman added the couple will be liable for tax on capital gains on resale. The files also reveal how a prominent Tory donor who supported Boris Johnson's leadership campaign was involved in one of Europe's biggest corruption scandals.
The campaign is over and the work begins. Thank you all very much.
A well-connected corporate lawyer, Mohamed Amersi, has given £525,000 to the Conservative Party since 2018. Here he is talking about corruption.
Corruption is a very, very heinous crime. Every stolen dollar robs the poor of an equal opportunity in life.
But leaked documents show Mr. Amersi was at the center of a corruption scandal. He worked as a consultant to a Swedish telecoms company, Telia, helping it to expand its business in Central Asia. But an internal Telia report describes the activities of a consultant referred to as Mr. XY, who was paid more than $65 million. The payments included expenses for lavish corporate entertainment, usually between $100,000 and $200,000 a month, that were not evidenced by receipts. It recommended that Telia's relationship with Mr. XY be terminated. Former Telia executive Michaela Ahlberg, who was brought in to clean up the company, told Panorama that Mr. Amersi was the consultant referred to in the report.
It is important that people around him, that trust him, that listen to him, understand the whole context of his career and wealth. He has been involved closely in one of the biggest corruption scandals that we have seen in Sweden in modern times.
Mr. Immersi's lawyer said it's entirely false to suggest his contract was terminated and that his fees and expenses were entirely in keeping with industry practice.
In one of his American legal dramas, you know, he agreed to become key witness in a way that he probably was granted immunity from the prosecution in a particular case.
And I've been asked at various points to speak about the techniques of getting money offshore and evading the law, but I think it's also important that you understand the mindset of these people.
Only because in the Western world, a large number of people are intoxicated with wealth, status, and power. If you suffer from malaria, flu, there is an antidote. If you are drunk, you may be sober tomorrow after a strong cup of coffee. But if you are intoxicated with wealth, power, and status, so far there is no antidote, and we need to develop some, because if we don't, it will really destroy the rest of society. So one of the things we need is strong and effective regulator. We don't have, at the moment, strong and effective regulators to deal with illicit financial flows in any European country. And more I will explain in a moment. This regulator needs to be well-resourced, not just going outside asking accountants and lawyers to help them to investigate, in other words, asking enablers to help the regulator. That is not on. Often the institutions haven't got any internal knowledge base or the memory because they are relying on external lawyers and accountants to do their investigation for them.
You know, after the Panama Papers, a lot of the discussion, you know, we think unfortunately transferred right to beneficial ownership disclosures, which I know we're going to discuss in greater detail later on in the panel. But in fact, through Treasury and other means, has already been kind of a robust framework in place. For example, and Aaron had mentioned it, you have the customer due diligence rules that were just approved last year and require financial institutions to kind of enhance the Know Your Customer requirements. You have the IRS SS4 form, which includes an entity's employer identification information, and the Secretary of Treasury is allowed to share that information with law enforcement if he believes there is an exigent need in criminal activity going on. They're allowed to share information of that entity with law enforcement. You have the FinCEN FBAR reports, which require U.S. citizens to report control over foreign accounts that are over, I think the number is $10,000. You have geographic targeting orders that are set up specifically for title companies that FinCEN, again, can look at certain areas where there might be bad activity going on. And then you have, of course, the IRS 6103 protections, which are the protections that are in place to protect taxpayer information from public disclosure. You have a number of exceptions in there where that information, with a court order, can be shared with law enforcement. So from the Chamber's perspective, we think it's a little unfortunate that instead of looking at this current system we have in place in the United States and figuring out where some of the gaps are, where some of the vulnerabilities are, and maybe looking at some targeted fixes to that, what's happened, and it's happened a lot in Washington, is you have a subset of bad actors, which make up a relatively small portion of the population. And the response in a lot of the proposals is, well, let's make everybody law-abiding, everyone, the American citizens, comply with a whole new set of rules and disclosures in order to try and catch, a small number of bad guys.
And do the prosecution for them, if any. So that we can't have. We've got to change that. The regulator also got to have information. I don't think the files of the accountants, lawyers in Panama Papers or in any other episode contain details about troop movements or position of spy satellites, which somehow need to remain confidential. These papers contain information which is essentially designed to rob the public purse. so the regulators must secure unhindered access to their files. Because without that, we will be chasing shadows as we have been for many, many years. We need more test cases brought to the courts. Even if they are lost, very soon we can change legislation. Often there is a lot of ambiguity about whether something is lawful or otherwise, and we never seem to resolve it. We need to address that. We need a single independent regulator dealing with the financial flows. You may be surprised to know in the UK, which is a tax haven on Thames, as I call it, there are 27 separate bodies dealing with illicit financial flows. 27. Nobody coordinates their activities. They are not overseen. Some of them don't even have enough resources. And the whole thing is a recipe for failure. I'm not aware of any European country which has a single regulator. And that is an essential thing. We need a concentrated effort. We can't just spend our resources coordinating 27 bodies, which include professional bodies representing accountants and lawyers. So what's happened in the UK? To this day, despite the court judgments, despite Luxembourg leaks and any other leaks, not a single accountancy firm has ever been disciplined or fined by any of the professional bodies.
Keith Oak, CBC News.
So world leaders, powerful politicians, billionaires, celebrities, religious leaders, even drug dealers, all targeted for hiding their investments in mansions, exclusive beachfront homes, yachts and other assets. It's according to a review of nearly 12 million files from around the world. It's the latest report by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists involving 600 journalists, naming people like the former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair, Jordan's King Abdullah, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and the German supermodel Claudia Schiffer. Also implicated, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Earlier, I spoke to a correspondent in Kiev. Gulliver Crane.
The papers reveal that Volodymyr Zelensky's production company, Kvartal 95, and numerous people associated with it and with him used offshore companies in order to store the money that they had earned for many years before Volodymyr Zelensky was elected president. There is no indication in these papers that this money was earned illegally, and already one of Volodymyr Zelensky's associates has been defending that practice, saying it was the only way to stop the money being targeted by corporate raiders in Ukraine's corrupt establishment. But then when this person was asked in the film made by Ukrainian journalists, why didn't you get rid of these companies when you became the establishment, he said, well, we're doing it, but it's a slow process.
And these professional bodies are one of the 27 regulators in the UK. I'm sure if you look at your own countries, you will find similar kind of outcomes. So that is a key requirement. We need an appropriate regulatory architecture that needs to be designed. And then we have a bigger problem. The regulators would say, yes, we got to have accountants on board and lawyers on board. So in the UK, our tax authority's chairman is a former partner of KPMG. Most of the non-executive directors come from companies and firms which have been implicated in tax avoidance. But the regulator's response is, I really got to have somebody who understands the technical details, forgetting that journalists, NGOs, civil society and ordinary citizens have exposed tax avoidance and thereby demonstrated a greater understanding of the tax rules and laws. But this technical logic prevails. We got to counter that by creating a supervisory board. So in Germany, at large corporations, there is a supervisory board
There is one aspect of this, though, where Volodymyr Zelensky could be seen as being on the wrong side of the law, and that is that there is one of these companies which he apparently passed to his associate, Sergei Shafir, when he was elected without any money changing hands. But that company is now, according to the papers, belonging perhaps indirectly to Sergei Shafir, but still paying dividends to Volodymyr Zelensky and his wife. If that's true, then that is perhaps illegal. But
four Rio Tinto employees, including Australian Stern Hu, were sentenced to years in prison over the scandal. Du went unpunished and went on to make billions. The leaked documents show Du Shuanghua's history of bribery was recorded in Asia City's files, along with his political connections to the Chinese Communist Party.
That makes him a politically exposed person by definition, by the anti-money laundering standards. I'm not surprised that someone like Mr. Du can buy the Hilton Hotel through a structure that perhaps hides the fact that he's behind it.
Trust, his father's trust, no longer domiciled in the Bahamas, but now in Ireland. Is Ireland considered offshore?
Depends. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know the case. I mean, come on. What is offshore exchange of information in 2017?
Philippines to Israel to Brazil, who are announcing that they've found offshore.
Hi, I'm Zach Davinsky. I'm based in Toronto, Canada. I'm
from the CIJ cooperation searched for the name Svetlana Kurbanagy, and they found it. Files showed her listed as the beneficial owner of a company based in the British Virgin Islands. It was called Rockville Development.
The documents surrounding that shell company indicate that it was created to hold property. And then it indicates that that property is located in Monaco.
We traveled with Miller to Monaco to find out more. On the Mediterranean Sea, Monaco is a low-tax principality popular with wealthy people from around the world. Miller and two other reporters were here trying to flesh out Kurbanagy's holdings and her connections to Putin. Jörg Schmidt is an investigative reporter from Germany's Süddeutsche Zeitung. Luke Harding is from Britain's Guardian newspaper and has reported on Putin's inner circle.
I kind of know these guys. I spent 4 years in Moscow as the Guardian's bureau chief there. And one thing I do know about them is they're very secretive, yeah. Especially when it comes to money.
Yeah. Isn't really a huge smoking gun here about Volodymyr Zelensky engaging in illegal activity. The thing is, though, is that all these arrangements with offshore companies, huge wealth and so on, completely clash with the image on which he got himself elected, which was the image based on this fictional character that he played in a sitcom of a man of the people who becomes president precisely because he's so sick of the elite and their vast wealth.
Papers. Let's start off with the former chairman of Citigroup, Sanford Weill. How is he connected to Mossack Fonseca?
Well, let me just introduce this by saying that some of these people probably had legitimate reasons to have an offshore corporation, because when you do international purchases or you maintain assets overseas, there's nothing illegal about it. And that, you know, certainly could be the case for the people we'll talk about in a segment. In the case of Sanford Weill, he is the beneficial owner of a British Virgin Islands company, or was, that took ownership of a 200-foot yacht called April Fool. So he turned up in the documents because his this was a company that was registered by the Panamanian law firm Mossack Fonseca.
Okay, there are some other folks connected to the Panama Papers, like the heir to the Hyatt Hotels, as well as the Campbell Soup fortune, right?
Yes, the Lyle Pritzker Simmons is a former child star in Hollywood, and she's also an heir to the Hyatt Hotel fortune. She's related to the Commerce Secretary, Penny Pritzker, now. And she set up a company that's called Blue Valley Agro Investment, This company has investments in palm oil plantations in Colombia, and she told my colleague here that investment is a green investment for people who want to have, invest money in companies that create jobs through agriculture.
What about links to Hollywood? What did you guys find?
Well, let me go on with a twist to that. And so another investor in that Blue Valley Agro investment is precisely another prominent name. It's John Thompson Durant IV, and he's an heir to the Campbell Soup fortune. So
you have this Russian dolls sort of arrangement where opaque and offshore structures are used to conceal ownership, and it becomes very difficult for an Australian bank, for instance, to unwind that ownership structure when we don't have things like a beneficial ownership register to show who are the ultimate people sitting behind these corporate vehicles.
Picturesque corner of northwest Tasmania, another Asia City client bought up farmland using a secretive offshore trust and company structure.
How the money came in was that a Canadian executive had a fund in Bermuda. The Bermudan fund advanced the money to a Singaporean company which acquired the Australian dairy fund. But when you look at the ownership on paper, the Singaporean company is owned by the trustees, two trustees of two respective trusts in the Isle of Man.
Asia City files reveal the source of funds for the purchase came from Canadian Stephen De Heinrich, who was a director of international oil giant Adax Petroleum.
We are an international oil and gas exploration and production company.
In 2007, two senior ADAX executives admitted to bribing a former Nigerian oil minister for lucrative contracts. De Heinrich made a fortune after the company was sold for $7 billion.
ADAX Petroleum, maximizing value for all.
The Tasmanian farms were sold back to local owners this year for nearly double the purchase price.
Does the Australian government really know who owns property in Australia?
No, probably not. And it's one of the advantages of having opaque structures.
Made up of employees, and employees are about half of that supervisory board, they can question the executive board. Let us modify that model and apply it to financial regulators, create financial flows. It is ironical that accountants and lawyers are undermining the public purse, and then we use the public purse to enrich them so that they can carry on with their games even more. That simply should not take place.
Supervised in the EU, intervention will be in Spanish.
A tax haven, that might be really difficult, but actually, no. It's actually worth creating a whole network of different companies, not just in one tax haven. In Mossack Fonseca, they created offshore companies in 21 different tax havens. So it's a whole industry using different havens, different companies and different names, and creating a real tangle of companies to make sure that even if there is a leak in the information involved, it would be very difficult to trace back to the actual owner of the companies. And when it comes to the Panama Papers, different tax havens were used. And after that, there was the Bahama leaks scandal in 2016. And the big banks, the big Swiss banks, UBS, for example, created 9,717 offshore companies, Credit Suisse, 8,299, and Banco Santander, 559. So this is a huge offshore industry using these intermediaries who are professionals, but they are a very important link in the chain. Now, when it comes to the intermediaries and what they do, I've always said that with the Panama Papers, we've got a hint of the scandal now, but it's just a drop in the ocean in terms of the offshore industry, because with the offshore industry, we're talking about millions of different companies in 40 or 50 different territories that can be identified as tax havens. And in this single office here in Delaware in the US, there are 300,000 companies registered in that one building. And in the Panama Papers, we've got a few hundred thousand companies. So this is just to give you a sense that this is the tip of the iceberg. Now, in terms of the services offered, well, I'm not going to go into too much detail here, but basically the intermediaries do what we want them to do. They create a bank account for us in Switzerland, for example, with an anonymous credit card or a prepaid credit card or return loans. If we want a combination of an offshore company with a bank account, we can have that too. But if we want the holdings, the taxation of holdings to be dealt with, then we can do that as well. We've seen that in the United States with the double Irish, the Dutch sandwich, and so on. And there are ways of organizing that in tax haven territories, which basically make sure that people are paying zero tax.
But also they're rather paranoid.
We're here for what I think is one of the most important stories and one of the most fascinating stories in the Pandora Papers.
What the reporters were finding in the leaked documents was yielding fresh evidence of how those close to Putin, like Kravonikik, were amassing hidden fortunes abroad.
What's happening is that Putin and his friends, his kind of inner circle, particularly friends from St. Petersburg, have become extremely rich, mainly on the back of state resources, oil, gas, things like that, and that they've created these colossal offshore structures where their assets are being hidden, and also that it's being done with help from the West. It's being done by an army of accountants, lawyers, company formation agents in this tax haven and other places.
In the case of Kravonikik, a month after her child was born, the shell company Brockville was formed and later purchased an apartment here. Luke Harding trolled through the property records and found the address,
which showed that Svetlana, Putin's close friend, actually owned a rather nice flat in the marina just opposite us, which she had bought for 3.6 million euros in 2003, 5 months after she gave birth to Putin's alleged daughter.
The journalists went to the apartment in the prestigious Monte Carlo Star complex. A woman who answered the door said no one named Svetlana Kravonikik lived there. Svetlana Kravonikik did not respond to repeated requests for comment. The investigative website Proact has estimated her assets in Russia alone are worth around $100 million.
She was suddenly going a bit like Cinderella, from being a cleaner in a store to having the lifestyle of a princess, with properties in Moscow and St. Petersburg, where she's from, in Sochi on the Black Sea, a share in a bank closely associated with the Putin regime called Bank Russia, and I discovered a secret flat in Monaco.
Nothing in the leaked documents directly linked Kravonikik to Putin. The Russian president has long faced claims that he has helped enrich his inner circle and used them to hide his own wealth, allegations he and the Kremlin deny. But in the trove of leaked files, there was something that tied Kravonikik and others close to Putin together. They all had used the same financial firm, Moores Rowland, in Monaco.
The two of them went into this. Now, we don't know exactly motives, but Lyle Pritzker-Simmons says it's because of this green investment strategy that they have. And so you asked about Hollywood.
Yes, Hollywood. What are the connections there?
David Geffen, film, music industry mogul, very wealthy man, very prominent. He figures in the documents as well, and this is related to the purchase of a $214 million yacht, Pelleris, that's anchored in the Caribbean. And the company, it was a Cayman Islands company that has control of this yacht, The company was later sold to another company that was registered, managed by Mossack Fonseca in Panama. So that's why his name popped up in the documents.
Now, Tim, one of the major criticisms over this leak is that there aren't enough American companies and politicians implicated, but plenty of ties to Vladimir Putin and Chinese businessmen. So some even suspect because USAID funded the investigation, there's been a deliberate attempt to suppress names. I want to point to a tweet that WikiLeaks had. They essentially say that the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, which it says, quote, targets Russia and the former USSR and was funded by USAID and American hedge fund billionaire George Soros. So as a journalist, what's your response?
Baloney. You know, we went into this. We're not a large news organization, but we do. McClatchy owns 29 newspapers spread across the United States. The company's investment in this project has been, by our standards, significant. We've had three reporters spending the better part of 5-6 months full time on this, with editors, leading and directing. And so, we didn't get funded by anybody other than the company coffers here. Now, ICIJ, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, is a nonprofit. And my understanding is that, yes, the parent company does receive funding from, Soros and other funds. But let me say, we went into this just as if you walked into the Library of Congress and saw 20,000 boxes there. We had no idea what we would find.
And
turns out that we found, our colleagues, 370 colleagues who took part in this, found some things that were pretty interesting on Putin. But, to suggest that we targeted him is silly. I think, it's looking very short-sightedly at the kind of far ripple effects that this investigation is having. Just today, you see the resignation of the CEO of an Austrian bank. You see protests at the Société Générale headquarters in Paris. The Malta legislature is considering a no-confidence motion in the government there. Look at smaller places. There will be news stories coming out in the future about what's happened in extractive industries in the Democratic People's Republic of Congo related to these offshore corporations.
Also, for folks that don't really understand your process, can you just explain to us a bit about how this all works? How do you even come up with these names?
It's been a long process. We simply, this is 11.5 million documents. It's a massive amount of information. In digital terms, it's 46 times bigger than the WikiLeaks leak back in 2010 of U.S. Diplomatic cables. So we've sat in front of the computer for months on end, typing in names, searching for things, we find things, but that's not the story there. I mean, we have to understand, have to look into other records and do phone calls to follow up on why somebody may have an offshore corporation, or why there may be a nesting of a series of offshore corporations.
My first guest tonight is one of the world's authorities on...
Then, here I can put it simply for you. How can we understand what is being done to get money, for example, out of Spain into another offshore company? If I've got €1 million as a result of whatever dodgy deal I've been involved in, how can I get rid of the money? Well, you just pick up the phone, you ring up a banking partner. This is basically making the most of cross-border banking relations.
Tax havens. Nicholas Shaxson has written extensively on the subject. He is with the Tax Justice Network here in Berlin. Nick, it's good to see you again. How concerned are you about what you have seen in these Pandora Papers?
Over the past years, a lot.
You have seen in these Pandora Papers?
Papers are. Well, there's been a train of revelations over the past years, starting with the Panama Papers and various other ones. The Pandora Papers are an especially big one. It's all very concerning. I would say that these are about a lot more than tax. the secrecy can serve many ends. Tax is just one of many ends. Ultimately, what we have here is two different kind of financial systems. One is for the sort of rich and powerful and the billionaire classes and so on, and another for the rest of us. I think that's really the heart of it. That's the big problem that our leaders and our kind of, you know, the great and the good, as they call them, are using these shady offshore centers. And this is just latest confirmation of just how deep the rot goes.
And obviously, when it comes to money laundering, there is a risk factor involved. So you just have to ring up a corresponding bank in Switzerland, for example, and they come to Spain, in this case, they pick up the money, they put the money in a national bank, but they do it in the name of the corresponding bank. So I'm the owner of the money, let's say, this 1 million euros that I got through my dodgy deal, but my name will not figure on any of the paperwork. It's the corresponding bank that manages. So this money is then automatically sent to a tax haven somewhere else. And the idea that then I, as a criminal, would go to the tax haven and live there is a myth. It's not going to happen.
Tax haven, in some respects, it provides financial secrecy for people stashing their money there, but it also runs this network of tax havens or secrecy jurisdictions around the world. The British Virgin Islands is particularly prominent, but other ones too. The revelations about Tony Blair and his even though the actual revelation itself was pretty small, what caught my eye, I think, was just the fact that they didn't know the identity of the sellers. They bought a property from a tax haven company. They didn't know who was selling it because it was hidden behind offshore secrecy. And then they said there's nothing unusual or underhand in any of this.
But I can get the money back to the country of origin using a return loan, for example, but there are other ways as well. All this means that a bank of the same group or another bank basically gives me a loan, and as a way of guaranteeing that loan, I use my dodgy money back in the tax haven. So in a matter of days, I will have laundered the money, and the money doesn't end up back in my bank account in Spain or Brussels or whatever, but rather I've got a loan from another bank, which is underwritten by my $1 million in the tax haven. So that's how it works. And there you can see that the corresponding bank relationship is a very important key in this whole chain. So let's talk about what I think is the most important thing here, measures against the use of tax havens. There are different blocks here. First of all, obviously, we have got to think about the measures that we need to adopt. Then, if there is an obstacle in the way, obstacle to free circulation of capital, for example, then we can use the directive on anti-money laundering, which is a European directive in existence, and that would be a perfect way to combat significant amounts of money laundering. But there are two key problems we face. First,
like companies, they're both. Again, they give an air of legitimacy that's owned by a foreign company, so it must be okay.
You know, the outrage that would be expressed by Australians if they knew that corrupt money was buying their local jewels in the crown.
As old, extorted just shy of $5 billion. So in 2012, the FBI and the Department of Justice got together and we started to investigate these funds. And what we found is there was a network of individuals that were not only helping President Abacha get his hands on these funds, mostly in cash, but then those funds had to be moved out of Nigeria.
In 2010, Asia City set up offshore trusts for a long-time associate of the president, Nigerian politician Abubakar Atiku Bagudu.
being hidden from tax authorities, criminal investigators, creditors, and the public.
Hey, Greg.
Early on, we began talking to Greg Miller of the Washington Post about what he was finding.
There were all kind of windows into bigger stories that you've been covering for a long time. And then you see, wow, there's more to that story than I was capable of seeing or understanding previously. And you have to build it out with material outside the files.
Around this time, a report surfaced on a Russian investigative website about a woman named Svetlana Krivonogik.
Обнаружилась интересная бизнесвумен Светлана Кривоногих. Ей принадлежит около 3%.
It was a story about a woman from St. Petersburg who had become mysteriously extremely wealthy. This very detailed account, they connected her to the Russian president, Vladimir Putin. Their story alleged that she had a secret relationship with Vladimir Putin, and that they had, in fact, perhaps even had a child in or around 2003.
Journalists from the ICIJ collaboration searched for the name Svetlana Krivonogik, and they found it. The files showed her listed as the beneficial owner of a company based in the British Virgin Islands. It was called Brockville Development.
The documents surrounding that shell company indicate that it was created to hold property. And then it indicates that that property is located in Monaco.
We traveled with Miller to Monaco to find out more. On the Mediterranean Sea, Monaco is a low-tax principality popular with wealthy people from around the world. Miller and two other reporters were here trying to flesh out Krivonogik's holdings and her connections to Putin. Jörg Schmidt is an investigative reporter from Germany's Süddeutsche Zeitung. Luke Harding is from Britain's Guardian newspaper and has reported on Putin's inner circle.
I kind of know these guys. I spent 4 years in Moscow as the Guardian's bureau chief there. And one thing I do know about them is they're very secretive, yeah. Especially when it comes to money.
Yeah.
But also they're rather paranoid.
We're here for what I think is one of the most important stories and one of the most fascinating stories in the Pandora Papers.
What the reporters were finding in the leaked documents was yielding fresh evidence of how those close to Putin, like Krivonogik,
Paladin, Paladin.
to CKUW 95.4.